Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, and welcome to the 83rd episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. Thanks for joining us in listening this evening, or in your car in the morning, wherever you are.
And we encourage you to tweet out using the hashtag EduAllStars, because we love seeing the things that stick out to you. We are really excited for this week's guest. We have Sean McComb, who has spent 8 years teaching at Patapsco High School and Center for the Arts in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's also the 2014 National Teacher of the Year. So thanks, Sean, for coming on with us today.
Well, thank you, guys, and thanks for this podcast you put together. You know, I think it's a great resource for teachers to get inspiration from each other across the country. So thanks very much for your work.
Awesome. Thanks, Sean. Well, Sean, the best way we always like to start with our guests is just hearing a little bit more about them and their kind of background and journey into education.
Sure. So my journey into education begins with my experience as a student. In my adolescence, late middle school, early high school years, I was going through a lot of tumultuous times at home. I had a really rough home life going on, and I had some teachers who saw that and made a choice to really invest in me. So at a time where I was becoming more apathetic about school, my grades were dropping, my kind of self-belief and self-worth was going the same way. I had a teacher who worked in an after-school program for broadcast communications, and he just gave me a safe place to work and pursue my passions and get really interested in doing some sports broadcasting for my high school, and gave me a safe place to be from 2:15 until 8 o'clock at night, so I didn't have to be in that home life environment. And at the same time that I was there, he was showing me, you know, that someone was making a choice to really value me and believe in me and give me all that. And then the next year, I had an incredible English teacher, Mr. Schertz. And he was really powerful in my life because despite what he knew was going on in my home life, he still held me to really high expectations, which seems a little surprising to say that, but he said, you know, the world is not going to drop its expectations for you, and I won't either, but I'm going to meet you where you are and help you reach them and give you the support that you need. So those two guys in my life helped me get through a really, really difficult time. And so when I left high school, I left thinking, you know, I want to become a teacher. I want to do for other people what these guys did for me and help me see a version of myself that I didn't see at first and I didn't know was there, but they kind of helped me uncover and build up.
Awesome. So you're currently not in the classroom this year, right? Is that right?
This is your like ambassador, travel, speak, see other teachers.
Cool. We'll get to that in a few minutes. So I noticed that you worked at a high school that's kind of classified as a center for the arts. How is that different than maybe like a traditional high school?
Yeah, so we have a magnet program within our high school. So we have a comprehensive high school, and that's about 70% of our students attend for that, and then 30% of our students attend for a focus in the visual or performing arts. Now, those students take all their non-magnet courses with other students, so they totally interact in those ways. And those magnet programs are also open. You know, students who aren't in the magnet can audition for the shows, can be in the choirs, and so it really adds a rich arts program to our students, which has really been a gem for the community and for the culture of our building, you know, to have the kids, the choirs come around and caroling around winter break and such incredible performances these kids put on. Just their talents are really impressive.
Well, Sean, I know that you were also as we mentioned at the top of the show, you were just named the 2014 National Teacher of the Year a few months ago. Can you tell us a little about that journey and how that came about?
Sure. So first I want to say, you know, what I really enjoy about the Teacher of the Year program in Maryland and in most of the states is that it's not something that teachers directly apply for. So I was nominated by my building principal as my school's Teacher of the Year, and I reminded him at the White House of our email exchange where I tried to deny the nomination 3 times. But he refused to move it to anyone else. And so I went building, and that entered me in my district competition. And district is the 26th largest in the country, so that's, you know, there's incredible teachers in my district, of course, like everywhere else, and was nominated. So I was named the District Teacher of the Year for Baltimore County Public Schools, and then that entered me for Maryland State with the 24 other district winners, Maryland Teacher of the Year, and that puts you in the national Teacher of the Year competition. Now, the story of interviewing with the 4 other finalists who are incredible teachers from Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida, I interviewed when my wife was 2 days overdue with our first child. So I was in D.C., she was in Baltimore. We're checking in constantly. There was some snow in between us, so things were up in the air, but I was able to get through the two-day final interview phase with the selection committee down in D.C., get home. She was induced the next morning. We have our first child, a beautiful son, and when he's 8 days old, I get the phone call to let me know that I was selected. Had to keep it under wraps for 6 weeks, couldn't even tell some of my family, and then it was announced at the White House on May 1st.
Wow.
Yeah, that's incredible. Congrats on the son, by the way. I was
thanks, yeah. It's been
a
year full of blessings.
Yeah, that's very cool. So you've wrote a blog post or a series of kind of sharing your mini stories of people that you come across, you know, when you travel around speaking as a National Teacher of the Year. Tell us about what the past year is like, you know, been traveling and speaking around the country.
Sure. So, you know, it's what an incredible opportunity to have this sabbatical. And not only, you know, I feel, you know, one of my pastors kind of challenges to come up with one term for our year, and mine was serve. So I'm trying to be a servant for teachers this year and try to encourage them, because so many teachers need encouragement kind of at this point in time. So that's a primary role, but I also get to meet and see so many incredible teachers. And so I've seen teachers coast to coast in all kinds of different classrooms and contexts, doing work in different content areas. And the common thread that I see throughout all of them is care for students and dedication to the work. And, you know, teachers who are, you know, a chemistry teacher who I saw here in Maryland, who's just really challenging students to problem solve and work with data and think really deeply about the lab results that they're seeing in a way that was really eye-opening for me, as far as, like, the work that they really do in that classroom. Through to an incredible Latin teacher in Indiana who is really doing deep literary analysis in Latin with his students, you know, across the country. I think this is the narrative that isn't always told in the media. You know, it doesn't grab headlines, it doesn't get clicks on the internet. You know, a teacher doing a great job.
Right.
But unfortunately, that's the narrative that needs to be told. It needs to counter that other narrative that is hurting the profession in some ways. And so, you know, try to share those stories, because I think too often as teachers, this is why I appreciate what you guys do with this podcast, we don't hear about the other people doing this amazing work that is happening across the country. It's phenomenal, and I always suspected it, you know, always assumed it, but to see it and meet those people and hear their stories and what they're doing and meet the students, it's powerful.
So when you travel around the country, do you have a platform that you're kind of, you get to choose, or is it like, this is what we want you talking about, or how does that look, what does that look like?
Yeah, so there's no, I've never been censored, I've never been told what to say. I had an opportunity to speak to the state chiefs, like the Maryland state superintendent and the equivalent across the country. And Chris Minnick, who is the head of CCSSO, he talked to me the week before the speech, and I told him some ideas I was thinking about. And he said, don't hold back. He said, remember, you're the voice of teachers there, and so if there's something on your mind, then bring it. And so, you know, I talked to them about testing and its use in evaluations and the research that I had read, and so many other teachers just, you know, this doesn't sit right with us, and we need some explanation. We need to understand why this is the way that we're going. And the issues, you know, some of us are facing that also, these don't make the headlines, but to see students suffering from the stressors of poverty in our schools and to see how that really affects their schoolwork and yep. How we need to, you know, make sure we're caring for the whole child. So I was able to do that kind of stuff, never been censored. You know, my platform has mostly been about how we can awaken students to the possibilities of their own agency, of really empowering them and equipping them to reach a future that they might not have known was there. It was kind of my story that teachers did for me when I was at a tough place in my life, and I've had a great opportunity to do that with my career at Patapsco. I teach in a program where I loop with students for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to forge these really deep relationships that are two-way. You know, they care about me. There are these great pictures of them celebrating the National Teacher of the Year. An art teacher made these big head cutouts of me, and so my kids are in the bleachers holding these head cutouts. They threw us a baby shower, my wife and I. You know.
Steve, but my question to you is, I looped one time, and it was so hard when I had to let my kids go and start over with a new group. I mean, I imagine it must be even harder when you've had them for 4 years, and it's like they're gone, and now you start all over again.
It is, yeah. So a couple of times I was maintaining two groups I was looping with. So I had the other to fall back on that I had for 2 years. But there's this process that happens in the spring of a graduating year that my wife knows about, where I make a video, like a slideshow of their 4 years with the pictures that I've saved over that time. And she knows that she needs to just go to bed early, and I'll just be downstairs crying as I put that slideshow together. Mm-hmm. You know, saying goodbye in those ways, so that hopefully when I'm speaking to them and we do a big farewell, I'm able to hold it together to some degree there, because they become a part of your life and they become kids that you really love. You know, you want so much for these kids, and you know them. You know what they're capable of because you've seen them grow over time, and that's been a gift.
Well, if you weren't a teacher, Sean, what do you think that you would be?
That's a good question. A tough question. you know, I think about what both of my parents did. And my dad was at first a community organizer, and then he worked through universities to do continuing education programs. So we grew outside of Philadelphia. And he would go to like the Naval Yard or a DuPont plant, and he would bring programs from the college there so that people could get their degrees, like their bachelor's degrees for the first time, and improve their careers. My mom worked for an agency to do early childhood intervention and go into these really tough neighborhoods in Philadelphia and help 3- and 4-year-olds be able to enter kindergarten on time, ready to learn from these really impoverished communities. And so I think, you know, I grew up, you know, I remember distinctly going to those Take Your Child to Work days and seeing what my parents did, and having the people that they worked with tell me what their work meant to them. So even if it wasn't in a classroom, I think it would still be finding some way to serve a community, to help people improve their lives. I think I kind of grew up with that modeled for me and kind of in my bones. And my family went through some tough times on our own, and so I recognize the kind of grace that comes with people making that effort in your life, and I just want to return that to people in another way.
What about, like, what do you think the most important quality that a teacher can possess is?
A single quality. So it's interesting. So Gallup, the polling organization, did a daily poll a couple years ago to ask people to describe the best teacher they ever had. And the word that came up more than any other single word is care. And, you know, it sounds soft, but we all know this, that when we walk into a classroom, you know, you get an immediate sense. And the kids, you know, they have a nose for this, right? It's like, If you don't care, if you're on the borderline of giving up, that's like chum in the water. they're going after that. They're gonna push you. And at the same time, if you really truly show a deep care for students, I think it changes your perspective a little bit. I think it makes you kind of look for the possible rather than look at deficits. Look for what kids can do, not what they can't do. And so that emphasis on caring, I think it is vital. And I think you know, you see a teacher who's burnt out, they've lost that kind of piece somewhere along the line. So I think a deep care for students is what carries the day. I think it's what gets us through the tough days. And I think it's what really helps us kind of go that extra mile when, you know, you're giving feedback on the 75th essay. I'm a high school English teacher. And, you know, you have 5 more, and they're the ones you were saving because they were maybe toughest. And you know, you bang them out for another 25 minutes, and you really give the kids what they need, or do that extra bit of work on an assignment to really make it shine and really make it engage kids. It's that emphasis on caring about the kids.
So, Sean, how do you motivate those really kids who seem totally unmotivated or could care less? How do you get them?
Yeah, so a couple of I'm going to try to answer from a couple different directions. The first is to remember, as human beings, we are built to learn, right? Learning releases dopamine. It's addictive. We should be addicted to learning. And I watch my 10-month-old son play in our living room, and just how curious he is and how he wants to check everything out and see what's going on. And I think to myself, what happens between 10 months and 10th grade? The kids come in and they've lost some of this. And can I instill some choice? Can I instill an opportunity for them to pursue their own interests that can reinvigorate some of that curiosity for learning? And I think that's one way to approach this. The other, I think, is for teachers to remember how important we are, just as, you know, someone who kind of sets the weather in the classroom, right? To be that decisive element, and to remember that optimism and joy is contagious, right? I've been spending some of this year reading a little bit about psychology, and we have these things called mirror neurons, that it's what makes you yawn when you see someone else yawn. but it's also what makes you feel happy when you're around happy people. So, you know, one thing that I do in my classroom is called a high-grade compliment, and this means that once or twice a week, I'll start class by choosing a student and in front of the whole class, you know, getting up, you know, close in proximity to them, looking them in the eyes and telling them all the wonderful things I think about them and who they are, what they do, what they're capable of, what I'm proud of them for. And this optimism sets a great tone for the rest of the day. You know, other things, gratitude journals, sharing for just 2 minutes at the beginning of class, positive things that are happening in our lives. I think if we can start on that positive note instead of like, hey, do this drill where you identify all the direct objects, which is sometimes not quite as motivating, is a great way to get things started on the right level. And then, as I said, number of directions, and then celebrating successes, celebrating growth, celebrating when kids get things right and when they make improvements, and making sure that kids see that and that they can see where they're growing. And then the flip side of that is, when things go wrong, when students don't do well, we need to make sure that they understand that it's part of a process, that everyone makes mistakes and that they'll learn from them, and that no one expected them to be perfect. And if they got everything right, then they're not growing, right? So we want to challenge all kids and have them realize that in that moment, they shouldn't feel shame because something was difficult, right? Their self-worth isn't on the line in this classroom, right? I love them. They're my student. I'm in it with them. We're going to get this together. But that their learning process is just what they're going through, and everybody's going to go through it, and they're going to be fine because they've learned something, so they can always learn, right? So I think from all those different angles, and never forget the power of personality for the teacher in the classroom, and that, you know, your will for positivity and for their learning, I think, can be really powerful and carry the day for kids.
Not that it sounds like you have much time to read, but have you read anything over the last year or that you're currently reading that you would recommend, like as far as education books are concerned?
Yeah, so I'll recommend one that is kind of definitely in the education wheelhouse and then one a little outside. I picked up a book called Possible Lives by Mike Rose. Are you guys familiar with this?
No, I've not heard of it.
So published in 1995, so it's going back a little bit. But when I read the preface, it could have been written in 2015, talks about public education under fire, a movement for more accountability and new standards in education, a worry that we're falling behind other countries, any of this sounding familiar to you guys? But this guy, Mike Rose, spends 2 years on the road going to classrooms in California and Arizona and Baltimore and all over the country and spending multiple days with these teachers and in their classrooms and observing what that teaching and learning looked like. And he wrote these great little vignettes about the students and their teachers and what's happening in their classrooms and the possibilities that are created by this uniquely American investment in a democratic public education. And really helped me remember what an investment this can be for our country if we're able to do it well and do it right. The idea that we want to have a citizenship that is informed and thoughtful and that they're going to be the shapers of the rest of our society. You know, so often districts define their mission statement by something like competitive in the global marketplace and like kids are only these economic factors. And this book really helped remind me that we should have this grander idea of students as people who are going to shape society, is going to be people who you know, curate our culture and are going to be the, you know, our people who are going to be shaping our ideas about justice and equality and so much more, that, you know, it should really expand what we think. So I've enjoyed that read very much. And then you know, if there are any teachers listening who are feeling down or troubled or like they're like it's a difficult place to be right now, being an educator in the classroom, I've met some people like this. I found this collection of essays called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, stories of hope and perseverance, and a collection that's just so moving and powerful for hope in tough times or all kinds of different circumstances and stories of overcoming difficult times. Great read, and I found it really, really encouraging.
Great. Those both sound awesome. And Todd, maybe that first one there, The Possible Lies, maybe we could get him on the show, huh? Just a head.
Yeah.
What about, you created a program called Avid. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I implemented Avid at Patapsco, but it has existed in schools as long as I've been alive. So started in 1983 in California, and the idea was, how do we get some students who might not have, based on tracking or previous performance, been identified as college-bound, and how do we help them become college-bound? These are the kids that I loop with for 4 years. So Avid, these kids come in as ninth graders, and they come in as kids who maybe have done well but in lower track courses, and they want to move into our honors or advanced placement courses. They have dreams to go to a four-year college, but there might be something that has, they might be first generation, they might be some other underserved demographic that we're going to invest some extra resources in, and we're going to help propel them. So I'll give you, it's a class they take as part of their daily schedule, give you an idea of a typical week. Monday and Wednesdays are kind of skill builder days, so we'll work on usually some English language arts skills that'll translate across different contexts, or organizational skills, habits of mind, study skills, these kind of things to support them in other classes. Tuesday, Thursday are tutorial days, so that's where they're struggling in biology or physics or calculus. They bring a question from the homework or the quiz that they got wrong or something from class they didn't quite get. They work in a group with other students and maybe an AP senior or a college student who we bring in to work as tutors. And they work in those small groups to get that kind of responsive intervention to make sure they get kind of things straightened out and get back to class ready to learn on time. And then on Fridays we do something kind of motivational. It might be career awareness, bring in a career speaker, might go on a college visit or college tour. Something along those lines. That's a typical week, and we've seen some great things from these kids. It's been my privilege to work alongside these kids who are really working their tails off to change their lives, change their trajectory. Last 3 years, 97% of these kids have been admitted to a four-year college, coming in not on track to do that. And it's a testament to those kids, their families, the school as a whole that's really invested in these kids. And I think the power of having that relationship over time, it's made me rethink how powerful a school that has like an advisory program could be, where they have that connection with an adult over the years who can really support them, or also hold them to a high standard when they need it. And it's been powerful. The really fun part is I built it with my wife. So my wife also teaches at the same school. This year we graduated our sixth class, and she and I have looped with five out of those six classes. And
wow.
So they call us like Mom and Pop McComb, and and we do like the mom dad tag team on some kids, and it's been a pleasure to watch this grow, and to step away this year and to see it still going and growing and working really well has been so great for me. So it's been a great program, exists across the country, and it's really helping kids persist into college.
So Sean, when you're having one of those really rough days, what do you do to help recenter yourself?
Yeah, so a few different things. One, at 2:15, our final bell rings. And the habit that I like to be in is at 2:15, we don't have any meetings or anything until 2:30. And I have those 15 minutes. They're usually lost in some, fog of exhaustion. And instead, I like to take these little this little stack of paper I have on my desk and write notes to kids, just encouragement, things that they did well, look for the positives in the day, think about, look at the grade book, see what kids have really been improving and doing well recently, and write them little notes of encouragement. And I find, whatever's happened that day kind of helps me refocus on the positive. So I like to do that before I leave school. If things still haven't sat well by the time I get home, this is before we had Silas, our son, I would go for a run. So we live a half mile from a beautiful trail in the woods, and if running through that trail for 45 minutes doesn't recenter myself, it's been an epically bad day.
Yeah,
that usually gets it done. So I think those kind of things, find something that's just for you, or find a way to change perspective on things, to look for the positives in the day and look for the kids who are doing well instead of whatever other frustrations might be going on, helps me step away from the stressors.
What about in this whole journey, like one of the biggest things you've learned over the last year?
So, I think for one of the things, when you're named National Teacher of the Year, you're not told why. So they don't give you like a list of reasons why you were selected. And for me, it's kind of been like, well, I need to go and figure out why. And there, you know, I think there's some things like my personal story and how teachers worked in my life, and then I paid that forward. I think that helps, or with the work that I'm doing to help get kids into college who might not have typically gone. But I've asked myself, why does my classroom approach work? Like, what has made that work over time? And so I've gone on this kind of journey of exploring positive psychology and cognitive behavioral science and try to understand what is it. And so some of those things I talked about the way that our brain responds to positivity, there's a researcher named Sean Acor out of Harvard. He worked out of Harvard for a while. He's a fantastic TED Talk. And you know, one of the studies he cites is that when we are at a positive place in our brain compared to negative or neutral, our brain is 31% more productive. And we have a choice about that. And he talks about how, you know, you make a choice to be happy in the moment where you are, find joy in your struggle, and find a way to grow through it, rather than say, I'll be happy when. And that's been something I've kind of always stressed with students is you know, don't look 3 or 4 years down the road for that high school diploma or the college acceptance and say, that will make me happy, right? Let's find a way to be happy with the incremental growth in between. Let's find a way to be happy because we're together in this classroom and given this chance to learn each day. And let's find some ways to be positive there and kind of grow some of those habits in students, not just happiness, but, you know, resilience or grit is the term that everyone throws around now. For me, it's about, you know, tenacity and going after our challenges. And some of those skills that are now coming into vogue a little bit more, I think one of the things really encouraging about education right now is that we're not just talking about, you know, what you know and what you can do, but who you are and how you work, right? And some of those personality traits, those soft skills, we're starting to realize those are really valuable lifelong outcome-wise. And it was set really well for me this year. I was at a tech forum, and I met some guys who worked for an engineering firm in Silicon Valley. And they were talking to me about how they hire people for their firm. And they sit them down and give them a problem set to solve, and they basically watch over their shoulders to see how they solve problems. Some of those problems they give them cannot be solved. There's no solution. So they watch how resilient they are, what different resources they go to when things don't work out. They watch what happens when they encounter failure. So that was, you know, really encouraging for me to think about how we challenge kids and how we kind of prepare them for a world where that will be part of how they're maybe evaluated for their jobs.
Right. That's interesting. So, Sean, what do you see as one of our biggest challenges in education right now?
You know, so the school that I work in, my first year, we were 27% free and reduced meals. This year, we're almost 60% free and reduced meals 8 years later. And I know that trend is true for a lot of places across the country. And, you know, that achievement gap between the affluence achievement gap is growing, and we have other achievement gaps that are, you know, at a point of crisis. So I think, you know, as far as, you know, a policy issue in education, equity has to be something that we're willing to talk about. You know, it hurts my heart to think about the kids, you know, the least of these, the kids who are least resourced, the kids who have the least are often in schools where they are then given the least, where working conditions are most challenging. And you know, while I have this platform and while I have this microphone to speak, you know, that's an issue that I think it has to be on our public conscience about, you know, what happens in those areas. And then, you know, in too many places, the school to prison pipeline that comes out of that and really thinking about what are we doing for these kids and, you know, who lost the lottery of birth and how unfair that is. You know, although we're 60% free and reduced meals, I have met so many of those kids who have come through my classroom, and I've been fortunate to work with other teachers and really make a difference in some of their lives. But, you know, I teach in reality, not paradise, and we've seen too many kids go the other way. And it's heartbreaking to see firsthand, and I think some of those firsthand accounts are what some policymakers need to hear. And so I've spent some of my opportunities this year sharing their stories and sharing what can happen in the positive way when we give these kids resources and support and their resilience and their humanity can really shine through. But we can't ignore the challenges that are created for them systemically and what we need to do about it from a policy perspective.
Right.
if you could go back to your first year as a teacher and kind of sit in your classroom, what kind of advice would you give yourself, like maybe at the end of the day?
So I think I would give, I would reiterate the advice that my best friend's father gave me. He's a third grade teacher, and it was, I was home on winter break and he lived nearby, and I was talking to his dad about my first year, and I had read, I read some book the summer before I went into the classroom, and the teacher in this book was working to exhaustion. He was, you know, one day he came home to his apartment and he just collapsed once he got in the door. He woke up there the next day. And so I thought I needed to be this teacher hero, and I need to do the same thing, and I need to work to exhaustion and be at school till 8 o'clock every single night. And he said to me, you can always do more in this job, right? There's always going to be another project to create, another great lesson plan, more feedback you can give kids. You can always do more. But he said to me, you have to do enough to look yourself in the mirror at night, but enough that you can keep coming back year after year after year. And so I thought that was great advice. Unfortunately, I did not follow it very, very well. And it's tough to do that first year. But that realization, you know, we hear you, I want to do more. I can do more. I can do more. You can always do more. There will always be more to do for these kids. But I need to find a place that was sustainable. And I learned it kind of the hard way, but I learned it eventually. And I think it's great advice for any new teacher.
Well, Sean, one of the questions that we always like to end on when we are interviewing our guests is, what is something that you are really passionate about right now?
So I'm super passionate about this whole child perspective, about what we're doing to encourage kids to be problem solvers, creative, to, you know, think about them in terms of their resilience and all these other qualities that I've seen through the work that I've done with kids over 4 years, over supporting them in all their other classes, and to see that we're starting to really come around to a place where this is being valued in schools in a major, major way. And I think that we need to be careful that it doesn't become something that we're trying to suddenly quantify. I know that there are some schools that try to grade character, which I think is a really slippery slope. But at the same time that we value these skills for students and these personality traits, I think it's a really promising place for us to be as a country, and that it's something that I think all educators should really think about, and think about how we're doing some of these things for kids in addition to content area, but how are we putting that kid and their skills and their ability and who they are and growing who they are as people, as well as a mathematics student or a world literature student.
That's awesome. Man, Sean, thanks so much for spending some time with us this evening. It was really great to get to talk with you on a more personal level. And how can listeners connect with you if they want to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so please do. I'm happy to support anyone. My word of the year is serve, so if I can serve any of you, let me know. I'm on Twitter at Mr_McComb. A buddy of mine made me a website, SeanMcComb.com, so there's like some stuff about my story there or ways to contact me if you want to check that stuff out. Some of the things that inspire me are on there too, so cool. Hope you check that out.
Yeah, and then on Twitter you can connect with us at EduAllStarsHQ, and our website's EduAllStars.com. You can search out EduAllStars with no spaces on iTunes, find all the past episodes as well.
And you can join us for our next episode as we interview Sam Patterson. So thanks again, Sean. We appreciate it, and we hope you have a great evening.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you.